Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the host and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have problems with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 238 of Registry Matters. It is 238, is it?
That is correct.
Pretty sure it is. Oh, yay. Good. I got it right this time. Happy Saturday night. How are you, sir?
Well, I was doing awful. I mean, doing well until I tried to clean my tub, and now I'm doing awful.
You know, so my solution to that, much like my kid hurting his stomach and it hurts to breathe, don't do that.
So don't clean the tub.
Don't clean the tub. Look, you are some, what are you, 170? You can find someone to clean it. Like, you're just you in your house, right? It's just you?
More or less.
More or less. Like, how often do you clean it? Weekly? Monthly?
Every 2 or 3 months when I can't stand it any longer.
Okay, good. Just hire someone to come in there every month and do it. I'm sure you can afford it, Larry.
Well, if FYP would compensate better, maybe.
Oh. All right, so step up your patronage so Larry can get a cleaning person to clean his shack. Is that what you're saying?
I like that idea.
Okay. All right, well, we'll get on that one. Would you be so kind, sir, to tell me all that we have going on this evening?
Well, we have a spectacular outline for tonight. We're going to be talking about an individual who wrote a long explanation about yes means no means no, but yes does not always mean yes.
Right.
And he explained in great detail about what the process is when you're accused under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. We obviously can't read all of that, but I picked out a part I'd like to read I thought was quite interesting. And we have a case that was just decided in the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals regarding moving out of state from Florida. And I put that in at the last minute. So have you read that case from cover to cover 2 or 3 times already?
2 or 3 times.
Okay. Then we have a case out of New York that has to do with an issue that is of great interest about the full faith and credit clause. So we've got, the theme is going to be a full faith and credit clause tonight in terms of both cases. And we touched on that on the last episode. So we're going to be zeroing in on what the full faith and credit clause can do and cannot do.
Okay. All right. Did you finish?
I think you have something that you're going to put in that had some chatter about a potential 70-year sentence.
Oh, yeah. There's an article from one of our recent guests and in a prominent magazine that I wanted to make sure that we featured. So I wanted to make sure that we brought that to everyone's attention.
So
that'll run the show.
Are we gonna do that article at the end or at the beginning?
Yeah, we'll do that at the end.
All right.
So the first thing up is this to be read from JRCF, which is, I can't remember what JRCF means.
The Joint Regional Correctional Facility over in Fort Leavenworth. That's where a lot of our former, I guess they're still military. I guess they don't kick everyone out, but they're serving sentences of varying lengths. And I think they're shorter sentences. I think they have another facility over there where they serve longer sentences. But this was something written. And I just took out a part of it. It was good stuff. We may publish some of it in the Narsal newsletter.
Okay. All right. So the article, the title is "No Means No, But Yes Doesn't Always Mean Yes." Why any of this should be at issue is the bigger problem, because consent can be withdrawn at any point to include long after the fact. Now, the idea of withdrawing consent is completely unquestionably legitimate. Just because someone willingly participates in sex does not mean she cannot stop at any point. If you agree to go up in an airplane, you can still change your mind about skydiving. The problem is the concept of withdrawing consent after the fact, sometimes long after the fact, as there is no statute of limitations in these cases. Now, women are not literally saying, I said yes, but I changed my mind now. That is one step too far toward being ludicrous. What they do instead is stop one step short of that and say, I said yes, but I was too drunk to have consented. And offer as proof only their recollection of being intoxicated and, at best, the recollection of some friends. This is why the war stories, in all of a disgusting glory, are so necessary. Guilt or innocent hinges on the memories, sometimes distant ones, of highly intoxicated people. There's literally no other instance where such logic would be acceptable. After all, you can change your mind about jumping only up to the point you step out of the airplane door. Imagine a person on trial for vehicular homicide testifying that she could not be held responsible for agreeing to drive because she had been too intoxicated to have agreed to do so, as evidenced by the fact that she threw herself up right before getting in the car.
So
yeah, that's a problem there.
Well, there's much more to that submission. We need to find out how to validate. We need to, the person who authored it was not the person, I don't think it sent it to us unless they're using a pen name. So we need to communicate with the person, but there may be some of that published, but it's kind of scary. You can withdraw your consent and say, well, I was intoxicated, and then you bear no responsibility for being intoxicated. I've never been intoxicated in my life, and I do not know how a person becomes intoxicated without some participation. So would you guys please enlighten me on that?
I can see like some frat stories where you're held down and people push the keg tube into your face and you're like, you know, college pranks. But beyond that, that one is tough to figure out. Like, maybe people slip stuff into your drink.
Well, now that is, I think that's, there's drugs that they do that with where they render people incapable.
Roofies.
So,
you know, Larry, I do want to bring up one thing. I got a whole mess of crap last week for not knowing what a White Claw is. And I just want to reiterate, I don't think I've ever been drunk in my life. I've had on count of five fingers is how many times I've had alcohol in my life. And I'm just not a drinker. So leave me alone, man. It's not fair.
What is a White Claw? Because I didn't know either.
It's a hard seltzer, I think is what I looked it up. So I guess that would be like a ginger ale, but now it's got booze in it and flavors. Somebody says it's a girl's drink. So there you go. There's that.
So, all righty. Well, and the other thing I had to mention, back in June, we received the first packet came in March from a person at the same facility. Then a much larger package came in June. And because we had said, I in particular have said that I really don't understand the Uniform Code of Military Justice and how parole works. And the person sent enough material that I can understand it now. I'm not claiming to have read every page, and the person didn't expect me to read every page, but I've read enough of it that I think I understand it much better now. And it resembles the old federal parole system prior to 1984 when the Sentencing Reform Act was passed. And I intend hopefully to reach out to the person's contact on the outside in the coming couple of weeks and find out if that person would like to explain in more detail what I still don't understand, because it is of interest to audience about making parole. And this person, at first glance, looks like they're being denied parole from the documents without a lot of justification. So, but I'm not in a position to pronounce that with any authority, but it looks like they're jerking him around.
Okay. Okay. And then I guess you want to do the Florida case?
Yes, that's from the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. I'll let you set it up.
Okay. So let's do this. And you put this other case. Of course, it's something you did last minute, so we have to have a bone pick. I get everything all set up, Larry. And you're like, oh, by the way, well, here's this thing last minute. So here we are last minute. It's Douglas Lindsay versus Florida Department of Law Enforcement. It's in front of the United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit. Can you remind the audience where the 11th Circuit is? I guess also tell us what it encompasses, or who encompasses the 11th Circuit. That's probably that way that it goes.
It's in the southeast United States. Geographically, it's relatively small. It includes the states of Georgia, Florida, and Alabama.
Let me expand on that. So let's see, 10 million people in Georgia, probably 25 or so, maybe 30 in Florida. Alabama's got like 55 people that live in it. So, but you end up with what, the Ninth Circuit that's got like a third of the country in it?
That is correct.
How do they're obviously not broken up in any sort of like representative way. So the Ninth Circuit, is the court bigger than the 11th Circuit?
Yes, it has more judges and it covers the largest geographic territory. What happened in the creation of the 11th Circuit is going to be difficult to replicate. Jimmy Carter was president, and at that time there was no 11th Circuit, and the courts were claiming that they were grossly overworked and needed more judges. So they created a lot of additional judgeships, which Carter got to fill. And they created the 11th Circuit, and they carved it out of other circuits, primarily the 5th Circuit. So prior to that creation, if you were in Georgia or Alabama, you would be in the 5th Circuit, which was in New Orleans. And I don't remember if Florida was in that circuit or not, but they created this circuit. The bipartisanship that existed then to create and expand the judiciary, see, now it's a Democrat plot to pack the court. If you want to expand the judiciary, they did a similar thing when George H.W. Bush, I forget how many, they didn't create any new circuits, but they created a significant number of new judgeships. But it's going to be hard to replicate that again. So that's how we end up with the 11th Circuit. They split up the circuits and created the 11th. There was talk of doing that in the Ninth Circuit, but it's not likely to happen anytime soon.
Really? Okay. All right. And you said Carter, so late 70s.
Late 70s, yes.
So it hasn't really been that long. Okay. It's not like it's been that way for 100 years. So this is something somewhat mutable.
It could be done again.
Okay. And I recall through the years we've done this podcast, you haven't been excited about the type of challenge Lindsay was making. His issue is that he remains listed on Florida's public website, despite the fact that he doesn't even live there. He's no longer required to register in his home state of Oklahoma. And I gotta wonder, Larry, do you people have zero heart? You have no heart, do you?
Well, I think I have a pretty big heart, actually. But unfortunately, the courts are not supposed to decide issues based on emotion. And I've been trying to analyze this through the years based on the facts. And the fact is that Mr. Lindsay was once registered in Florida, and it's historically accurate, which means his claim is weak, to put it mildly. And until the United States or a state within the United States adopts a law that a person can cite to, that there, at the moment, there is no constitutional right to be forgotten. And remember, folks, I don't make the rules. I'm just a messenger. I wish such a challenge were viable, but unfortunately, my humble opinion, it is not as it existed in that case. Now, there would be an instance where such a case would be viable, have much more viability, and that would be in a case like with Wisconsin, because Wisconsin continues to allege that it has control over you. Florida doesn't. Florida just says, you sailed off into the sunset. You were here. We're reporting that. They scrub the address, I think, from where you were living, and they say living out of state, and Florida's done with you. Wisconsin takes the position that you owe us $100 a year monitoring, and you have to continue to keep us informed as to where you are. That would be the same as Wisconsin saying you have to continue to pay your vehicle registration fee, even though you've taken your vehicle to Florida. So the way the challenge was set up in this case, he had a very weak claim. But that's not to say that a correctly set up challenge would have viability. This one didn't. I said that to him, and I'm saying it again now. The fact, if you're listed on a registry, that in and of itself is not enough under our current law to get you any type of relief.
And according to the court, Douglas Lindsay appealed from the district court's dismissal of his suit against Richard Swearingen in his official capacity as commissioner of the Florida Department of Law Enforcement. Mr. Lindsay argued that, based on an Oklahoma state court order finding that he was no longer required to register as a PFR in that state, Florida's PFR registration regime is unconstitutional as applied to him under the full faith and credit clause. That sounds familiar. What's wrong with his argument?
Well, before we go there, let's set up the case a little bit more. Lindsay had been deemed a level 3 offender under their old risk-based system in Oklahoma. They used to actually do an evaluation of risk, and they scrapped that at some point, don't remember the year. But in June 29, Lindsay filed a motion for review of his lifetime risk assessment duration. And in September of 29, an Oklahoma district court issued an order finding that Lindsay was a level one PFR. And pursuant to its authority, under blah, 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 it determined that based on the new designation and the absence of any legal trouble for a period of 10 years, he was no longer required to register under the OSORA. Soon thereafter, he was removed from Oklahoma PFR offender registry. Rather than staying put, he moved to the great state of Florida. And I keep track of the time because we have the dates here. So go.
Okay. In 2011, Lindsay moved to Martin County, Florida. He did not register as a PFR. In 2017, November of 2017, the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, which maintains the registry, informed him that he was required to register. Lindsay complied. This is probably the failure right there. Is like he should have gotten out of Dodge. Later then, in June 2019, Lindsay formally requested that the Florida Department of Law Enforcement remove him from the Florida registry based on the Oklahoma order. The FDLE denied his request, stating that because he was released from the sanction imposed for his qualifying crime after October 1st of 1997, he had a requirement to register in Florida. So tell us what happens next.
Well, before I do that, I would just like to point out that from 2011, 2017, that hovercraft took a while to find him.
It seems like it did take some time.
Yeah. Now, what we don't know is if he got ratted out by someone who knew that he had the old conviction in Oklahoma, or if he encountered some law enforcement. They didn't tell us that. Now, if I'd have dug deep enough into the lower court, I might would have found what triggered this information. But it's not like the hovercraft picked up right away. But anyway, in August 2020, Lindsay moved back to Oklahoma. As a result of that move, Florida law no longer requires him to provide his registration update information or anything for Florida, but the Florida registration remains publicly available, including on the internet, and therein lies the problem he and many face.
So then, according to the court, as a general matter, for a person with out-of-state convictions like Lindsay, residency in Florida triggers the registration requirement. Lindsay specifically was required to register because his offenses of conviction, the sanctions from which he was released after October 1st, 1997, were similar to certain enumerated offenses under Florida law. He's not in Florida any longer, so then, Larry, why can't he be removed, along with the other 50,000 people in similar situations?
Well, they could be, but they have no right to be under law. But according to the court, under Florida law specifically, 943-0435, Subsection 11A, some PFRs may petition for removal of the registration requirement after 25 years, but not those convicted of offenses such as sexual battery or lascivious offenses or similar offenses in another jurisdiction. And then they go on to say the Florida PFR simply does not provide a mechanism for removal from the Florida registry upon domiciling outside the state. So it's just not in the statute.
I do honestly think, though, Larry, it seems like a no-brainer to me. So he's no longer in Florida, and the court itself said the full faith and credit clause requires the states to recognize and give effect to the public acts, records, and judicial proceedings of every other state. U.S. Constitution Article 4, they went on to say the purpose of the full faith and credit clause was to alter the status of the several states as independent foreign sovereignties, each free to ignore obligations created under the laws or by the judicial proceedings of others, and to make them integral parts of a single nation through which a remedy upon a just obligation might be demanded as of right, irrespective of the state of its origin. He has an order from Oklahoma. Let's see you spin your way out of this. You people need to figure out how to spin your way out of this.
Well, I'm just going to rely on what the court says because the court disagrees. They said, according to Lindsay, the Oklahoma order is a final judgment entitled to exacting full faith and credit in Florida. Like the district court, we disagree. Lindsay's 1999 Oklahoma convictions remain in place and their validity is not in question. This is not a case, therefore, where the underlying conviction has been set aside and the Oklahoma order based solely on Oklahoma law, that is, the authority granted to the Oklahoma District Court under Oklahoma law, does not purport to bind any other jurisdiction, nor as Oklahoma, as a general rule, have extraterritorial jurisdiction to exercise police power in Florida.
They can I would like to say that that would be extraterrestrial jurisdiction.
So, you know, the fact is, as I've said, how many times on the podcast, when you do your fancy search, one state cannot relieve you of another state's obligations.
And another state is, right, therefore not obligated to follow what another state does. It does in either direction, either in your favor or not in your favor, right?
Well, that's what the case law appears to say in this particular case. This was a non-published opinion, and I didn't put that in our plans, but a non-published opinion is not binding precedent. It's kind of like a decision from another jurisdiction. You can cite to it, and you can say what brilliant analysis it is, but you can't compel any other court in the 11th Circuit to follow it. But the courts are not finding a lot of sympathy for this argument so far.
And you said that, this came out in the last day or so. So you haven't done a full Larry analysis of it. You've done just sort of a cursory overview of it.
I've done analysis of the 11th Circuit, but not the underlying district court. The district court decision may have been more comprehensive, but I didn't read that prior to this because I just actually got it last night when I sent you the message. Yeah. So.
All right. Well, we need to probably get out on this one. The court concluded that the full faith and credit clause does not direct us to resolve this conflict in Mr. Lindsay's favor. In fact, it prescribes just the opposite, as the clause does not require Florida to substitute the OSORA. Oklahoma? Is that what that? Yeah. Oklahoma SORA. Is that what that would be?
That's what it is.
Okay. So they don't have to substitute the Oklahoma SORA for the Florida PFR Act, citing Hyatt 578 U.S. at 176. They said Florida has a legitimate interest in prescribing the manner in which it protects the health and welfare of its citizens from persons convicted of PFR type offenses. So what else do you have before we move on from here?
Well, the court also stated Florida need not dispense with its preferred method of doing so because another jurisdiction has less restrictive requirements on PFR registration. As the district court essentially recognized, even if Oklahoma did not have any registration requirements for offenders like Mr. Lindsay, the legislative choice would not prevent Florida from enacting a PFR registration scheme. So you can come to Florida and say, I don't have to register, and they can say, too bad, so sad, you shouldn't have come here.
I do want to wonder, so somewhere in there, what we just said is that they have, Florida has a legitimate interest in prescribing the manner in which it protects the health and welfare of its citizens. Isn't that a condition where we could go back with evidence saying that this doesn't do what you're saying it does?
You could. I don't think it's going to gain any traction because it's a rational basis, the test that gets applied to this. Whether something works or not is not a part of the evaluation. What you look at, is it rational to want to protect the safety of the community? Yes, sure. It is. It's rational.
Sure.
That ends the inquiry. So
we don't need evidence to support a rational basis just because it's a logical statement to make it. It doesn't require evidence to back it up?
It does not. Okay. In a free society... In a free society, we get to impose irrational laws on ourselves.
And is there a type of inquiry that the evidence would be required?
Well, as you're going up in the review standards, you know, to intermediate scrutiny and then strict scrutiny, yes, more evidence is required. With strict scrutiny, you know, when you're talking about First Amendment, it has to be there has to be a compelling governmental interest that must be shown by evidence, and it has to be the least restrictive means to achieve that government interest. But in terms of just having a law, we could restore the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit tomorrow. There doesn't need to be a shred right. of evidence to support that.
I got you on that one.
So,
okie dokie. All right, well then, so we'll move on to the New York case?
I suppose so. I feel bad about this because there are a lot of people who really do believe that I'm crazy when I tell them this, and I got even some grief when I said something to the effect of, it's only a website. And I don't mean to diminish a website. It's not a fun thing to be on if you're presented in an unfavorable light. but you have no reporting obligations. You have no disabilities or restraints. Your life is not altered. Now, if Mr. Lindsay wants to come forward with evidence, with real evidence, how this is altering his life, he is free to initiate a new cause of action. He can put forth some kind of ridiculous theory that he might not be able to travel internationally because he's listed on Florida's registry. It's hypothetical until he's denied travel. Now, of course, my position is they don't deny anybody the right to travel. You just have to provide the notice. But he is no longer required to register in any jurisdiction. He would only be required to register in Florida if he were to return there. So he's merely listed on a website, folks, with no disabilities or restraints other than the fact that it's an emotional thing. You prefer not, most people would prefer that their dirt not be aired publicly. I would agree with that, wouldn't you?
Oh, without a doubt.
Okay, so it's like if you had an ugly divorce. Most people would probably prefer that divorce allegations and some of that file be sealed from public exposure, and they do their very best. But he's got to show how he's being harmed by this. The fact that he doesn't like it is not enough. I don't like what's on the internet. I'm sure that all of us find things that's less than flattering now in this digital era that we're living in. But not liking it doesn't make it unconstitutional.
It's government-sponsored doxing or sanctioned doxing.
So, well, it's to my understanding, they're not really putting out any information on him that's private. Like I say, I think they're just listing the fact that he was there. There's no address attached to it. He was registered at one time in Florida. That's historically correct.
I gotcha. All right.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app, hit the subscribe button, and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
All right, so New York. So this is New York versus, you people put this case in here named People of the State of New York versus Matthew Corr, and that's C-O-R-R, from the Appellate Division of the Supreme Court of New York, Second Department. It has to do with the clock restarting when a person moves to New York. And I think this case fits nicely with our last episode dealing with the full faith and credit clause. Larry, you've developed a theme here for the last two episodes. The last one had to do with the full faith and credit clause as well. Tell the audience in less than, see, I'm going to make it 1 minute. 1 minute what this case is about. Go.
1 minute. Sure. According to the court, this appeal presents an issue of first impression as to the duration of registration and verification of a level one PFR who was convicted of a qualifying offense in another jurisdiction, registered in another state, and subsequently established residence in New York. Is that fast enough?
I believe you did it perfectly. And I read the case twice now, and it's so blatantly obvious that the court got it wrong. Can you at least admit that the court got it wrong?
I'm leaning in that direction, but I can't admit it.
Damn it, man. Okay, so the court stated, we disagree and hold that the initial date of registration referred to in that statutory provision means the initial date of the offender's registration with the Division of Criminal Justice Services pursuant to New York's PFR Registration Act. If Mr. Corr was registered in another state and subsequently relocated to New York, how can there be any question about his initial date of registration? Doesn't the word initial means the first date of registration?
Not necessarily. It depends on the language of what the statute says.
All right, you're hopeless. So upon moving to New York, Corr did not contest the risk level designation, but instead argued that the date of his registration under SORA should be made NUNC Pro, N-U-N-C Pro, TUNC. Larry, I don't know what these words mean. What do these words mean?
Well, it's an order issued today as if it had been issued on the previous date. It's Latin, and it simply means now for then.
All right, so NUNC Pro TUNC to January 29th of 2016, the date that he first registered in Massachusetts. He asked the Supreme Court to credit his registration and verification requirements with that time. What the hell? Please tell me what nunc pro tunc is again.
It means you would set up the order as if it had been issued then, so it means now for then. So what he was wanting was an order from the court crediting him with the time that he had been registered in Massachusetts.
Is this like backdating a check? Or post-dating a check?
Sort of. You're making the order, like a court sometimes makes a mistake. They get the judgment wrong. Okay. So you go back and correct the order, and you want the order to have effect from the date that it should have had effect. So you issue.
Okay, so like retroactive
order,
then.
The order is titled nunc pro tunc. So it supersedes the previous order, and it would make it effective.
Okay, I gotcha. And so I note that the court stated it is fundamental that a court, in interpreting a statute, should attempt to effectuate the intent of the legislation, as the clearest indicator of legislative intent is the statutory text. The starting point in any case of interpretation must always be the language itself, giving effect to the plain meaning thereof. What does this mean?
It means words matter. They're interpreting what the word initial means in the context of Mr. Core's registration. When did he initially register? Where a statute describes the particular situations in which to apply and there's no qualifying exception added, an irrefutable inference must be drawn that what is omitted or not included was intended to be omitted or excluded. So the legislature did not include anything that said credit. So that's what they're saying. Hey, we just wear these robes. We don't make the law.
So sometimes you have judges that overwrite law, and then other times you have them saying, we're staying away from that one. All right. So I did zero in on that. They stated here, the legislature addressed a PFR relocation to New York from another state in correction law statute 168-K and did not provide that the duration of registration in New York was impacted in any way by the registration in another state. Had the legislature intended to diminish the registration obligation of such a PFR, it easily could have so stated that. They went on to say the provision concerning PFRs whose crimes were committed outside of New York and who established residence in this state has been amended numerous times, yet the legislature had not provided the duration of registration in New York should be pro forma reduced by the amount of time the offender was registered in another state. Now I know where you're headed, Larry.
Correct. The court concluded that the legislature's failure to provide such qualification compels the conclusion that it intended for a PFR establishing residence in New York to register for the statutory period of time from the initial date of registration in New York, following the board's determination that the offender is required to register with the division pursuant to SORA. So, I'm sorry, folks, but words matter. If you want there to be credit in there, just as we're trying, have tried and failed in this state to get credit established in the statute, we don't have it. So when you look at the statute, it says what it says. And I know you wouldn't want judges legislating from the bench, would you?
We're back to the full faith and credit clause. Did Core argue that?
He did argue it on appeal, but unfortunately, the court held that Core's contention that the Supreme Court's denial of his request for the full faith and credit clause of the Constitution is unpreserved for appellate review. It appears that he did not develop that argument below, which precluded it from being reviewed on appeal.
Do you think someone else later could argue that?
I think they absolutely could. Based on the case that we just did, I'm not as optimistic now as I was a week ago. But absolutely, this is an argument that is worth making.
Interesting. Okay. These are kind of wonky, Larry. These are a little bit in the weeds for my little pea brain.
They're not a little complicated. You're just making it complicated, aren't you?
That's probably very true in the grand scheme of things. Probably very true, Larry.
What I would say is that the lawyering on this case could have probably been better, you know that any argument you're going to make on appeal, you need to make it below. You've got to give the trial judge an opportunity to rule against you. And if you're going to argue full faith and credit, you need to develop it below and you need to get denied below. Now, it could be that he had a different appellate lawyer who was trying to reach for something and raised it first time on appeal. But as a general rule, courts are not going to entertain an argument first time on appeal if it wasn't argued below because the trial judge didn't get a shot at it.
Okay. Again, wonky. You're talking about some lawyer strategy stuff that I think goes above, at least my pea brain.
Well, when you think about the court system, the appellate courts are fewer in number. You may have hundreds of trial judges out there in a state, and you only have one court of appeals. So therefore, they cannot be reviewing everything that you could have done and giving you an opportunity in an appellate forum to do what you should have done.
Sure.
I mean, that's all they'd be doing is trying cases all the time. Because everybody would think of something that they didn't do and that they could have done. So therefore, they just can't review on appeal what you didn't develop below. You've got to give the trial court an opportunity to rule on your issue, even if you know that they're going to rule against you. And that's difficult, particularly in criminal settings for people when the judge is not buying it and the judge is conveying with their body language. You have to say, look, Your Honor, I need for you to let me lay the record for appeal. And you practice in front of that judge regularly. It's hard to say, Judge, I need you to stop because I'm laying the record. I know it's going to make no difference here, but I'm making a record.
And if I'm not mistaken, the upper level courts, they don't introduce new evidence in. They're just basing everything from the lower courts on what the evidence was presented at that time.
That is correct. And that's the angst that a lot of people have when they go into the Smith versus Doe, because the facts that the Supreme Court used were decided by the parties below. And I say that despite the fact there are legal gurus out there that have written all these articles and published them about how they got it wrong. In my opinion, they got it exactly right. As the law existed in 2003 in Alaska, there was no punitive effect of the Alaska registration at that particular time. So they got it exactly right. You need to get over that, and you need to develop the evidence now to show that that generation of registries no longer exist. You need to build an evidentiary record below. You need to argue with the court when the court doesn't let you build your evidentiary record, and you need to set it up so you can get a remand so you can build your evidentiary record below. But you need to get over Smith versus Doe. It's ancient history, and let's move forward from here. The parties stipulated to that evidence, to the facts as they existed, by the way they managed that case from beginning to end.
And if you will indulge me for a minute, I was having a conversation with someone recently, and I presented a lot of what you just said, but so just for my edification, that I responded the right way. We need something of a exceptional plaintiff under the right conditions with a lot of disabilities and restraints to start running something up the flagpole, and it needs to go through the lower courts, the middle courts, the intermediate courts, the high court, all the way to get to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has to be willing to hear it because they see something wrong with what was done to the person so that they could then essentially do something that overturns Smith.
That's largely correct. That's largely correct of what would need to happen.
They don't just wake up one morning and say, oh shit, we got this wrong. Let's go back and revisit this 03 decision, a 20-year-old decision, and this is where they got it wrong. They don't do that.
They don't have the authority to do that. A case has to come before them. Now, they've had opportunities to take cases dealing with this issue that they've declined. Remember, they declined the Pennsylvania case. They declined the Michigan case. They were not convinced that there was anything that they needed to review. So they declined to grant cert to both of those cases. But at some point, there could be an egregious enough case where they could revisit registration and they could come up with a different holding. I'm not optimistic about this particular court, and I haven't been for some period of time, but I can't control what people file cert petitions on. You know, there was a guy in Kansas. You remember the case, What Are We Litigating? That went to the Kansas Supreme Court.
Yes.
When the justices are asking you, what are we litigating? It's not what the justice said, something to the effect of, it's one thing to disagree with the points, but it's another thing. We don't know what we're litigating. Well, when you have a case that's
I think I need to capture that audio and just hold on to that one. So we can play. what exactly are we arguing here?
Why are we even here? So I can't control what people will file cert petitions on, but I can tell them that this court, as it is constructed right now, doesn't have a lot of empathy. This is not the Earl Warren Court that came out with all the things that prisoners cite to, the right to remain silent, you know, the Gideon decision, Brady versus Maryland. This is not, this court doesn't exist. That court hasn't existed for a long time. And they're not inclined to do anything, but people continue to believe, well, we need to get a Supreme Court decision. That's fine. Let's go for it, but let's build the case correctly with a registration scheme that is very oppressive, that has lots of disabilities and restraints, and we box them in and we say, you can't continue to ignore this. You said, your court said in 2003 that you allowed this to stand in Alaska because it didn't impose any disabilities or restraints. You said in 2003 that there are these seven factors used to determine if something that's called a civil regulatory scheme is truly civil regulatory and non-punitive. You set those seven factors. We have demonstrated by evidence below that we've met five or six or seven of those factors. You cannot continue to say that this is not punitive. And hopefully that would work. But what happens if it doesn't? What happens if that case gets there and they say, still, we choose to stick with the Smith versus Doe? Then we're set back for another 25 years.
And $100,000?
Well, I'm not even worried about the $100,000, but you're set back for 25 years. Sure. Because the states that have even considered any reduction in requirements, would the floodgates would be open for the law enforcement apparatus to come in and say, oh, we can stack on more. We don't have as many restrictions here as that state did. And the Supreme Court said that was okay. And then all of a sudden, you've got the license and open door to make the registry even tougher. This is a risky business, folks. This is a very risky business that we're in terms of what we're trying to do. And we have to be very judicious and very cautious about how we take cases to the court.
Then one final question before we move on to the article or two is, with those two, the Michigan and then the Pennsylvania ones, not being heard by the Supreme Court, did that improve or not improve, hinder the situation overall?
I don't think it really altered the thing. First of all, that court that turned those cases down no longer exists. There's three new justices since then. But they didn't need to hear those cases because they were pretty cut and dry. They were decided largely under state constitution, particularly the Pennsylvania one. So there was no jurisdiction there. The Michigan case, I think, was decided on both. It's been a while back now, but I don't think it really changes anything in terms of this court. This court is not your friend, folks. It's not. Get over it. It's not. You want to believe that it is. It's for small government. It's going to end everything. It isn't.
All right. Okay. Let's see here. Then there's that article. All right. Well, then Emily Horowitz, who is a good friend of mine and a friend of the podcast. And if you go back to the episode that we did at the conference, she was a guest on the program with a panel. And she had an article published in Reason Magazine that the title is 18-year-old faces possible 70 years in federal prison for Snapchat sexting crime. And I wanted to pretty much just ask you a question or two. And basically, I'm confused that it says, so he was 17 when he was doing this. So in my brain, he would be charged as an underage person. And the individuals that he was communicating with were, as far as I understand it, 16 years old. So only a year difference. But he's not an adult. And as I understand it, is that they waited till he turned 18 before they actually filed charges. And that doesn't, like, makes my head spin around in circles. Like, if the crime was when he was 17, then shouldn't they apply the laws to him as a 17-year-old? What's the deal with them waiting till he's 18 to then really put the hammer down?
Well, I don't know the answer to that in its totality. Generally speaking, you're correct. When a person commits a crime, it's the penalty scheme that was available to them, to the prosecution, to the court at the time they committed the crime. That's the basic ex post facto clause. We cannot subject a person to a different statute or penalty than would have been available. It gets a little bit murkier than that, though, because sometimes the person could have been prosecuted as a juvenile and they could have been prosecuted as an adult, even though they were 17, even though they were 16. There's the potential they could have been prosecuted either way. It's prosecutor discretion. Well, if I'm a prosecutor...
Would this be like for like a super heinous, like I think Malvo, one of those, the DC snipers, they're underage and they decide to go charge them as an adult for the crime?
That is correct. In some state, it's prosecutor discretion. They don't have to file anything. In our state, it's a very, very rigid prosecution, a process where they have to show that there's a non-amenability to treatment before they move a juvenile to adult court. And as I've said many times about the Sam Donaldson, particularly the younger they are, he was 14 at the time, the one that killed the father, mother, and sister, killed his family, and he was tried as a juvenile here, and he was already out of prison because they can't keep him past their 21st birthday. But in this particular instance, since I don't know the federal practice, I'm not sure what the feds' options are with dealing with underage offenders. It may be that he can be prosecuted under as a juvenile or an adult. It may be discretionary, but folks, he's not going to get to 70 years. That's just the maximum penalty that if everything that potentially they've charged is convicted, if he were to be found guilty, not negotiate a plea, that's a maximum stacking the charges. But nobody gets the maximum. Seldom does that ever happen.
Now, I was going to say, what about the 292 from last week, man?
Well, that wasn't a maximum. Remember, he
that's had, true. He was going to get 400 or something.
Yeah, he was facing well over 500 years. He only got about a little over half of it. I mean, what is your complaint, man?
Okay, sorry. So if he gets somewhere roughly half of the 70, he's looking at 30 and change. Oh, whew, sorry. So he only misses more than, like, he's only 18 years old and he's going to serve more time in prison than he's been alive. Good grief.
Well, not so simple. First of all, we don't know. This doesn't look like the internet loper who did this once. This looks like there was a substantial amount of this stuff happening, at least based on the story, right? This was not a guy who just stumbled upon it one day and did it once and left. Is that the way you read it?
Something along those lines. Yes, I'm still at the 17 and 16 year olds having access to the technology to take pictures of the junk and just press go. I like it is so, the friction level is so low. Back in your day, you had to take it to the photo mat place and get it developed, and you're going to get in trouble at that point. It would be really hard to develop photos at home on your own. Now you have a full 4K production studio just sitting on your iPhone or Android phone.
So, well, if he does choose to negotiate a plea, he will be able to probably get rid of many of those counts. And that'll be a part of the prosecution negotiation that you've got 20 counts, you reduce it to 5 or whatever. And then if he accepts responsibility by negotiating a plea, you know, they have this sentencing scheme where they look at the severity level. So you want to start with getting the prosecution to agree with that you plead to the least serious crime. So that drops the level. And then there's the career history points. It's hard to imagine that he's has any career history of crime that's going to be significant in the calculation as young as he is and just has moved beyond his juvenile status. But so they start with those factors, and they're going to come up with a range of sentencing that he's going to be subject between X number of months and X number of months. And the judge is going to be able to pick between those. And the attorney's going to put on mitigation that he's amenable to treatment, he's young, and on and on and on and all this kind of stuff. And hopefully he doesn't come out with 70 years. But she's trying to illustrate the point. And the point is well taken, that these sentences, the potential exposure is enormous. And therefore, you have to come in and cut a deal. I mean, he can't risk going to the trial. I can guarantee he confessed. He told them how he did everything. He admitted that it was his. There's nothing to work with other than trying to set aside the confession that he made, and that's difficult to do. So he's going to end up with a negotiated outcome.
If I can turn over to the technology side for a minute, even if they were across the street neighbors, because the Snapchat servers are located in California, that means it's the equivalent of him getting in that airplane, flying over to California, using the photo mat to develop the photos, and then transporting them back. So now he has distributed CP across state lines. And that's how the feds get involved, is because all those little bits, ones and zeros, they are not following what path you would think of that little short little hop across the street. They're going all around the globe. So you end up with interstate commerce and possibly like international commerce.
Absolutely. Well, it was noted in the article that under Kansas law, he probably would have facing something like 4 to 20 years, but he's not under Kansas law.
Yeah. Just simply because he used Snapchat, if he find a platform that was local to his neighborhood or something like that, and then it may not have traveled across state lines. But you know, Larry, he used Snapchat, so then the prosecutors just put together like the cookie cutter answer. They didn't go trace that the images were sitting over there. They just know that's where they went. So therefore, then they have in a federal jurisdiction. They don't have the photos sitting there from Snapchat servers. I can almost guarantee you that.
You're way over my head. I don't know what they have.
Yeah, so. That's garbage. Well, garbage. Hey, someone posted in chat, don't talk to the police. I think we did that recently.
Yeah, we did that. But but his public defender had recommended he take a plea that would cap his incarceration at 20 years and perhaps maybe as little as 12 to 15.
But still a long time for 17 years old, man.
So, he said he sent a note. Says recently, Breyer received some good news. He sent a note to the judge pointing out that he was just a month away from September 27th trial date and still did not know how the public defender planned to argue the case. This moved the judge to dismiss the public defender and allow a pro bono lawyer to take over. So now his trial's been pushed back indefinitely. So maybe the case will take on a different course now with a new attorney coming in. But I mean, that's
and pro bono means like not. I'm not trying to bag on public defenders, but someone that can focus time and attention on it, that is a normal level of workload attorney, obviously doing this for no money. Is that what that means, right?
The pro bono does mean without pay. I don't know that pro bono attorney is going to necessarily have a lot more time. The pro bono attorney could be driven by the notoriety of the case and want to get his or her name out there into the public domain.
Oh, I see. Someone trying to make a name for themselves, eh?
It's a possibility. I don't know. So
interesting. Okay. Is there anything else that you would like to cover in, let's say, 5 minutes before we shut this thing down?
Shut it down? We've only been going for like 15 minutes.
Yeah, exactly 15. How about 51 and change?
What is wrong with you people?
I know. And I'm okay going like longer, Larry, but apparently some people hurt themselves and they want to go home. Maybe their loopy pills are actually kicking in. But so let me, like, okay. So instead of an article, can you commit to when we will do a chat with Larry episode? When you would be willing to come online and talk to our peoples?
Let's do it tonight, from now till midnight.
I can't announce that to people in advance of.
Well,
are you willing to stick around though? I mean, I'll go tell everyone.
No, let's tell them before the month of September is out. So it's either next week or the week after, because we got two more episodes. No, we got okay. One more. The last one will be on the 1st.
October 1st. Yes, that would be on the 1st. So can you tentatively give me a day this week?
So I will do that. Yes.
Okay. All right. So is there an article you would like to cover, or should we just let it go?
So I think that we have done a huge amount of work in a short amount of time. So maybe short is better.
I'm okay with that. I think that'll be just grand. And so without anything else, I will bid everyone adieu. And you can find all of the show notes over at registrymatters.co. You can leave voicemail at 747-227-4477. And email registrymatterscast@gmail.com. And of course, support us on Patreon, patreon.com/registrymatters. Or if you want to, you can go over to fypeducation.org, fypeducation.org, and there's a donate button there to do a one-time to the 501c3 that we have. And without anything else, Larry, I hope you have a splendid evening, and I hope you feel better.
Thank you. Well, you forgot one thing, to hit subscribe.
Oh, I did. All right, I'll do it right now. Here, go find all the subscribes and the likes buttons. And there you go.
And give us 5-star reviews and talk on the YouTube channel. There's not enough people responding, although a guy did make a request on YouTube this week. Did you see that?
Is it the one about what does FYP stand for?
No, it's what it told us that we should provide some entertainment for the holidays. And he suggested,
oh,
he suggested,
I don't know what that means.
He suggested that we do a duet of a Little Drummer Boy.
No, that's not happening. I have a mission this year. I'm perfectly poised that I will not listen to a single Christmas song through the whole holiday season. That is my goal. Every year is my goal, and I usually fail, but that's my goal.
So, you people, what is wrong with you?
Yeah, I'm just Mr. Bah Humbug. Well, Larry, I hope you have a great night, and I will talk to you very soon.
All right. Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.